watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WUS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We all learn in our school civics courses how our Constitution ushered in a rule of law to replace the rule by men. But what does this mean, really? The laws, after all, are made by men, a few hundreds of them. And the laws are a reflection of the men making them. And these men have, over the course of our history, made laws that declared some of us to be property, denied others our dignity or livelihood, and use the power of the state to interfere in our most personal decisions according to their particular biases. Another civics class platitude is that no one is above the law. But this program has presented week after week evidence that the lawmakers and the law enforcers do not follow laws they find inconvenient, or they alternatively make self-serving laws, then pompously enforce them. This hypocrisy stands out when it comes to the issue of war crimes under international law. Only the weak or defeated are prosecuted. In other words, behind the legal window dressing, might makes right. The Citizens' Tribunal on Iraq, held in conjunction with the federal trial of four peace activists in Binghamton, New York, a few weeks ago, took on the issue of the U.S. invasion of Iraq as a war crime. And this week, we're going to hear a panel of legal experts present evidence of war crimes and violations of the U.S. Constitution committed by our so-called leaders. These legal experts were not allowed to testify during the St. Patrick's IV trial, nor were the activists on trial allowed to argue their legal rights and obligations to prevent war crimes of their government. The four activists were prosecuted and will be sentenced for spilling a cup of their own blood in a military recruiting center. But the presidents, generals, and the soldiers who obey their orders spill thousands of gallons of other people's blood with impunity. Many people have been sentenced to decades in prison for having some marijuana plants in their closet. But officials such as Elliot Abrams, convicted of lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra affair, was pardoned by George Herbert Walker Bush and now serves in his son's administration. Abrams was lying about his role in managing U.S.-sponsored death squads sent in to overturn the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. As another example, Robert Earl told a grand jury that he had destroyed and stolen national security documents while working for Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North during the Iran-Contra scandal. Earl now works at the Pentagon as chief of staff to the Deputy Secretary of Defense. He has a clearance to review the kinds of classified documents he once destroyed. But an environmental activist who torched a couple of SUVs on a car lot will spend 23 years in prison and not have many job opportunities when he gets out. Let's set the stage on this war crimes examination with a report from last Thursday's Flashpoints program on how democracy, a constitution, and the rule of law are being brought to Iraq. Robert Knight begins the story.
In today's Knight Report, an analysis of the Bush administration's ethnocidal military operations in western Iraq, which are intended to suppress a Sunni rejection of the U.S.-designed Iraqi constitution in the October 15th referendum. I'm Robert Knight in New York. There were more bombs and resistance attacks in Iraq today, including car bombs in Baghdad, which killed more than a dozen police, oil officials, civilians, and U.S. mercenary contractors. The Bush administration administration claims the continuing insurgency is aimed at disrupting the October 15th referendum on a U.S.-designed constitution, which was edited by Washington and its Iraqi proxies to allow the partition of Iraq's oil provinces and the permanent presence of U.S. military bases. On Wednesday, President George W. Bush said, quote, "We fully understand the insurgents intend to disrupt the constitutional process or will try to do so," end quote. But it's actually the Bush administration itself, which is matching or exceeding al-Qaeda in the disruption of next week's referendum by suppressing Sunni voters and registration in exactly those provinces that might have vetoed America's colonial constitution for Iraq. Earlier this week, the U.S.-supervised Iraqi parliament backed away from a scheme to count yes votes for the Constitution as a proportion of actual voters, while counting no votes as a proportion of the greater number of registered voters. On Wednesday, following United Nations complaints, the unfair counting scheme was reversed by a vote of 119-28 in the 275-seat assembly, which ironically would have been insufficient for passage if the legislature had applied to itself the rules it tried to impose on Sunni referendum voters. But opponents of the U.S. Constitution are facing military obstacles as well. Over the past several months, the U.S. Army of Occupation in Iraq has engaged in major operations aimed at infiltrating, disrupting, and neutralizing the no vote against the draft Constitution in the three Sunni provinces of Anbar, Saladin, and Nineveh in western Iraq. Claiming to fight insurgents, U.S. forces have seized territory, closed bridges, imposed curfews, initiated patrols, conducted arrests, and caused major population displacements of potential Sunni voters along the populous banks of the Euphrates River between the Syrian border in the west and Baghdad in central Iraq. Military operations in Sunni Iraq have taken on multiple code names over the past few weeks. With negligible assistance from undertrained Iraqi troops, the Pentagon has been engaged since September in so-called Operation Saratoga, which Washington describes as, quote, shaping the security environment for the October elections, end quote. Saratoga consists of raids, intimidation, and voter displacements in Saladin, Diyala, Kirkuk, and Sulaiminia, and in the cities of Baiji, Samara, Dulaya, Bakuba, and Balad along the Tigris River. Earlier this week, Operation Rivergate hit the towns of Haditha, Haqlanya, and Barwana, and sealed bridges to enclose and isolate Sunni communities and force evacuees into the U.S.-controlled city of Rawa, through which all travelers must now pass. More than 1,000 U.S. Marines of the 3rd Battalion, 6th Regiment initiated Operation Iron Fist in the northwestern towns of Qaim and Sada near the Syrian border. Meanwhile, nearly 1,000 members of the 224th Engineer Battalion of the Iowa National Guard have been engaged in Operation Mountaineer in Ramadi with tanks, airstrikes, and population sweeps. The aforementioned operations are part of the Bush administration's Uber strategy called Operation Hunter, involving thousands of troops with the ultimate goal of using airstrikes, incursions, and arbitrary arrests to establish a permanent U.S. military presence in the restive Sunni cities along the Euphrates west of Baghdad. The intended side effect of these operations can be more clearly seen from the perspective of voter displacement prior to the October 15th referendum. According to data from the federally funded Center of Excellence in Disaster Management and Humanitarian Assistance, the U.S. operations have displaced thousands of families. In and around Tal Afar, where the Sunni Turkmen population was assaulted by U.S. troops and Kurdish militias, nearly 3,000 families have been displaced, representing an estimated 30,000 potential voters. On September 13th, the Iraqi Ministry of Immigration posted an even higher estimate of 7,000 families displaced during the Tal Afar offensive, which killed 600 or more residents or alleged insurgents. Several thousand more families were displaced from the western town of Sada and nearby communities. Moreover, the United Nations is estimating that in July alone, more than 6,000 people were displaced by conflict and incursions in the Anbar province. Despite the Bush administration's unsupported claims of counterinsurgency operations against alleged foreign fighters, which comprise 5% or less of the resistance in Iraq. The implications of the current U.S. military offensive in Anbar and other Sunni territories are obvious. To suppress anti-constitutional votes among skeptical Sunni communities of central and western Iraq through displacement, arrests, lack of documentation for voter registration, and pure military intimidation. In other words, the United States is now deeply involved in the suppression of Iraqi democracy with the military equivalent of ethnocide. That is, cultural-based aggression whose goal is the long-term erasure of a group's legacy from the historical record. In this case, the Sunni vote in the October 15th constitutional referendum. And that's some of the news of this Thursday, October 6th, 2005. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
And I'm Dennis Bernstein. Thank you for that very good report. Robert, this is a very important analysis and story and reporting you just put together for us. Let's just very quickly sum this up. In essence, we're seeing a sort of a textbook disinformation campaign to do that which you're accusing the others of doing.
Oh, it's magnificent the way that Newspeak is being applied for this anti-democratic military operation of the Bush administration in Iraq. Not everybody is falling for it. For instance, the Iraqi member of parliament, Mishan Al-Jabouri, said today, and this is a direct quote, "What we fear most in the governance that contain mixed residents is the targeting of Sunni Arab neighborhoods. In order to prevent Sunnis from attaining the two-thirds of the consensus required to vote down the Constitution at the referendum." Some of the most obvious lies that are being told in this campaign, Dennis, include the following: that it is actually a counterinsurgency operation near the Syrian border to keep out foreign fighters. Well, no credible authority from the United Nations to even the Pentagon itself has ever been able to produce evidence of anything more than a few trickle of a few percent, maybe 5%, of people who have been inflamed by the occupation of Iraq who come in to volunteer their resistance activities against the occupation, but barely 1 in 20. The other big lie is that this is, the other thing about the so-called foreign fighters is that the domestic, patriotic, or nationalistic Iraqi resistance has way more ordnance than they need. You'll remember that before the invasion, arsenals and explosives, millions and millions of pounds of it were stashed and stored in secret locations all throughout Iraq. So there is a domestic supply base for the improvised bombs and ammunition and so on. The other big lie is that this is an Iraqi-forged constitution. Perhaps the word forged is not false, because you had a selective election back in January, as we covered nationally on January the 30th, in which Sunnis were excluded from voting. They did not open polling places. They did not have a chance to vote then. And as our colleague Der Jamel has pointed out, and others have many times, the Constitution is basically a United States construction or invention. The two key clauses that make it so urgent for Bush and company to get this thing passed or to deny the veto of it by Sunnis and other dissidents is that it allows for permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq and, with an eye towards the future, over the secession of the Kurds with the oil in the north and of Shia communities with the oil in the south.
Robert Knight. Now we go to senior producer Nora Barros-Friedman, who introduces and interviews Dar Jamel.
Well, the complicated intricacies of the Constitution take up much airtime on national corporate news stations. Many human rights advocates in solidarity with the Iraqi people are reminding the international community that the entire process of passing this Constitution in the context of the war of aggression and the U.S.-led occupation are all fully in breach of international law. Joining us to talk about the campaign to call attention to the illegalities of what's happening in U.S.-occupied Iraq is our special correspondent, Dar Jamel. Dar is a signatory, along with dozens of activists, lawyers, authors, historians, and journalists, appealing to Amnesty International and other international human rights groups to hold the U.S. accountable for war crimes and breaches of international law in Iraq. Let's talk about the upcoming vote on the so-called Constitution. What's the significance of the Iraqi National Assembly reversing the last-minute changes that would have been unfair to the Sunni minority?
Well, at the end of the day, it's really a situation of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because where we had a situation, it was very clear before the recent machinations within the General Assembly of where we were going to have a referendum vote. It's very clear that that's going to be the referendum will be vetoed by the Sunnis in at least three of the provinces. They are a majority in four of the provinces, and so by a two-thirds vote, there, without a doubt, if it is a legitimate vote, this constitution is dead in the water. There, with political wrangling going on with the Shia bloc, they had essentially moved the goalpost. They were going to make it a virtual impossibility for the Sunnis to overturn this. Instead of a two-thirds actual vote, they were trying to arrange it to where it would have to be two-thirds of registered voters would be needed, which would make it a virtual impossibility, because they're just not going to get that kind of turnout anywhere in Iraq, let alone in Al-Anbar province, where there's ongoing major military operations. So that was very recently repealed, as you said, under political pressure from the UN and the U.S. So now we have the referendum vote back on track. So now we're steaming ahead once again for the abyss of October 15th.
That's the voice of our special correspondent, Dar Jamail. Dar, what's being left out of this constitution, and why have you signed on to an open letter to Amnesty International? What does it say?
Well, this letter essentially was created by the group of the Brussels Tribunal from the World Tribunals on Iraq, the one specifically in Brussels. This group has remained consistently active in their efforts to bring to light what's actually happening in regards to the occupation and violations of international law. And this letter was essentially aimed directly at, it's an open letter to Amnesty International, and I want to read you a quote from it, because the recommendations in the annual report of Amnesty International for 2005 said, quote, if the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibility in regards to human rights violations in Iraq, Amnesty International calls on foreign governments to uphold their obligations under international law by investigating all senior U.S. officials involved in the torture scandal. Said Schultz, who added that violations of the torture convention, which has been ratified by the U.S. and some 138 other countries, can be prosecuted in any jurisdiction on the planet. The Amnesty at one point had, as I just read, called for an investigation be launched by various countries around the world into human rights abuses by the U.S. in regards to torture. And this letter has been written, and I decided to sign it, because it's calling on them, rather than pushing now, as Amnesty is, for to have more human rights concerns addressed in this Iraqi constitution, but rather than that, to remind Amnesty International that to some of the things that were, some of the conclusions reached by the jury of conscience by the World Tribunal in Iraq in the culminating session, specifically regarding the illegality that this constitution has, even just by existing. I mean, some of the recommendations of the World Tribunal regarding the Iraqi Constitution said that, for example, any law or institution created under the aegis of occupation is devoid of both legal and moral authority. The recently concluded election, the Constituent Assembly in Iraq, and the current government itself, and the drafting committee for the Constitution are therefore all illegitimate. We are trying to show that this constitution, what's in it, the people behind it, all of this is a violation of international law. Essentially, it is another giant smokescreen being put out, just like the January 30 elections, just like the June 28, 2004 supposed transfer of sovereignty in Iraq from the Coalition Provisional Authority to this interim Iraqi so-called government. All of this is essentially doing nothing to respect international law and doing nothing to make the lives better for average Iraqi people.
Dar, if this constitution passes, how will it affect the U.S. occupation and the future of any sovereignty for the people of Iraq?
It really will do nothing to help the average Iraqi person. This constitution, I should remind people, it was authored in the United States. It was written in English, translated into Arabic. This facade that this so-called Iraqi parliament were wrangling over the writing of a constitution is just that, a facade. They weren't actually writing a constitution. Instead, they were arguing over a few different contentious issues, which they never actually got ironed out, in fact. So this constitution really is not about helping the Iraqi people. It's not going to do anything to bring the Iraqi people any true sovereignty or a better life, and it's certainly not going to do anything to end the occupation. And I think at the end of the day, that's what we need to all consistently be talking about, is what has to happen to bring to an end this illegal occupation that came on the heels of an illegal invasion of a sovereign country.
Dar Jamail, independent journalist who testified in Brussels at the World Tribunal on Iraq. He was speaking to Nora Barrows-Friedman of Pacifica Radio's Flashpoints program last Thursday. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. Next, we go to Tarek Abdelazim as he introduces the panel of legal experts who testified 2 weeks ago at the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq in Binghamton.
I've spent the last few days, because I haven't been too busy, getting a law degree online. So I'm your moderator this evening. And for those of you who weren't in the courtroom, there was a comment made by the judge, and I don't want this to be a jab at him, because I'm certainly taking it out of context and it wouldn't be fair. But when Teresa Grady was giving some testimony, the lawyer, the prosecutor, said objection, and the judge said objection sustained. The jury will disregard the Iraqi people. And I think last night, if you were here to join us for the Voices of the Victims panel, there's a very good reason why he would want us to disregard the Iraqi people, as well as the administration and the makers of war. There are two things, I think, that cut straight through intimidation, deception, and manipulation, and that's grief and suffering. And I think in Crawford, the sight of a grieving mother was very powerful. And then I think the suffering that we've seen with the Hurricane Katrina close to home made us realize that two weeks without water is an incredibly short distance, or a short time, when we think of Iraq cities that have been suffering for 2.5 years without water, and that there should be absolutely no difference with our outrage over those suffering from Hurricane Katrina as those suffering from the policies of our government. So it's very important that we do open ourselves up to that grief and suffering. And then it's even more important to make sure that we understand the legal framework in which we can pursue any kind of path without excluding impeachment of the criminals of this administration. We certainly want to get started, and first I'd like to introduce at the far end of the table Scott Horton. He's an adjunct professor. I'll finish first, and then we'll give him a rousing applause. Scott Horton is an adjunct professor at Columbia Law School, where he teaches international public and private law and the law of armed conflict. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, chairs the advisory board of the Eurasia Group, a political risk and policy analysis group, and was a founding trustee of the American University in Central Asia, a higher education project launched by the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan governments and the Soros Foundation. He has been a lifelong human rights advocate, serving as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, amongst others. He is a director of the International Law Association and chairs the New York City's Bars Committee on International Law, and it is a pleasure to have him stand in solidarity with the St. Patrick's Four and join us for the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq. Scott Horton.
I want to thank you for those words of welcome. And I also want to say, looking at this room this evening, I see that the spirit of John Brown and the spirit of Susan B. Anthony lives in upstate New York today. But I also want to say, when I look at the federal courthouse, I see that Judge McEvoy has forgotten about Justice Jackson. So I'm here this evening to remind him. Unlike many of you here this evening, I did not oppose the war in Iraq when the Bush administration initiated it. I trusted the statements that President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and others made, claims that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction and that Iraq therefore presented an immediate threat to the United States and our security. I'm not a pacifist. In fact, my father was a career military officer, and I at one point worked for the Department of Defense. I have very high faith and confidence in our armed forces and in their traditions. And first of all, that means the tradition that was set out by George Washington in 1776 of humane treatment of prisoners. That tradition was put in place before our republic was founded and was honored by every president of the United States, every president until George W. Bush. Now, it turns out that I and the rest of the country were deceived. We have been led by an administration that uses deceit and fear-mongering as its modus operandi. It has brought us corruption and cronyism at levels that have not been known in our nation in the last century. This administration has betrayed the fundamental institutions of our government and has worked tirelessly to undermine our democracy. It has brought death and destruction to thousands of American citizens and to people around the world. For many honest and patriotic citizens, this is a government worthy not of loyalty, but of contempt and defiance. But, significantly, the conduct of this administration in taking the nation to war on the basis of what is now exposed as a tissue of lies is criminal conduct, and we have a right to resist it. You know, there was a time when this nation had great leadership, not like the crew we have leading us now. In modern times, our greatest president and our greatest attorney general both hailed from New York State. Franklin Delano Roosevelt of Hyde Park and Robert Jackson of Jamestown in the Southern Tier. And who gave us this principle I just discussed? Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Robert Jackson did. In his declaration in 1944, and then in Justice Jackson's elaboration of that declaration in 1946, they put forward the principle that was then established as a matter of international law, that an unprovoked war of aggression against a sovereign nation is a crime, and the political leaders who undertake such a war are themselves criminals. And those leaders forfeit the right to loyalty and obedience of their citizens with respect to such a criminal enterprise. I quote America's greatest attorney general, quote, "To initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime. differing from other war crimes only in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. The individual citizen has a right not only to refuse support of such criminal activity, but to obstruct it peacefully. That is what the law says. That is the law on which our nation was founded, the law that was cited by Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, and others in support of the Revolution, the law that was espoused by Cicero and his Republic, by Montesquieu and the Spirit of Laws, by Blackstone in his commentaries, and the law according to Robert Jackson. Now, it may be that the St. Patrick's Four committed a trespass to property. So did the patriots who staged the Boston Tea Party. And that was our cousins in New England. So let me cite some New York examples, too. So did the citizens of New York City when they stormed the Bowling Green in 1776 and toppled the statue of King George. Their conduct, like the conduct of the St. Patrick's Four, demonstrated love and faith in their country and in their God, and a willingness to take risks to try and awaken the nation from a dangerous slumber. As Thoreau and Emerson stood against the war with Mexico and braved the wrath of a warmongering nation, so the St. Patrick's Four have stood against this war and earned the admiration and respect of their fellow citizens. And I cite first among them the 9 jurors who voted to acquit. This administration should have respected the judgment of that jury, but are we surprised? This administration is indifferent to the will of the people. That characterizes this indictment. This administration wants to intimidate, wants to use fear. Today I ask you, who are the criminals? Not the St. Patrick's Four. Let us look closely at those who are bringing these charges, at the Justice Department, at its leadership, at the authority based on which these charges are asserted now. Defendant 1, Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States. In 2002, Alberto Gonzalez wrote that aspects of the Geneva Conventions were obsolete and quaint, and he advocated dispensing with them in the global war on terror. Under his direction, a series of memoranda were crafted which justified and authorized the introduction of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. In fact, Jackson Deal, an editor of the Washington Post, wrote this last week that he and other members of the editorial board met very recently with Al Gonzalez. Deal asked Gonzalez, quote, "Did you authorize the use of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment on detainees in the global war on terror?" A very direct question. And Gonzalez answered by frowning, slouching, looking obviously distressed, and then mumbling, "I'll have to get back to you on that." And you know what? He never did get back. And you know why? The answer is, he did. He did. And I've seen the documents by which he made these authorizations. Gonzalez violated the criminal law of the United States, and in particular, because we should charge with specificity, Title 18, United States Code, that's the criminal code, Section 2340A, which prohibits torture, and Title 18, USC, Section 2441, that is the War Crimes Act of 1996, which makes grave violations of the Geneva Convention serious felonies. Now, what kind of crimes are these? Are they like the trespass to property crimes that are being charged against the St. Pat's Four? No. These are very serious crimes. In fact, they're potentially capital offenses under our criminal statutes. So, let me start again by paraphrasing Justice Robert Jackson. At the end of the Second World War, a number of German lawyers were brought before Justice Jackson, who was then serving as the U.S. prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials. And some in the U.S. entourage said, well, they're just lawyers. They were just dealing with the law. Why should they be charged? And Justice Jackson said, they bear responsibility as much, if not more, than anyone, because they are the guardians of the law. So in his indictment, Justice Jackson said these words, because this man is a lawyer and thus charged with knowledge of the law, his clever evasions and parsings cannot be countenanced, but must to the contrary be weighed against him. And as he knew in making these interpretations that they would justify conduct leading to the death or physical abuse of countless human beings, then morally and before the law, he must be considered an accomplice to murder and assaults that occurred resting on his authority. In fact, individuals were murdered in direct consequence of Gonzalez's authorization of torture and abuse. Others suffered severe assaults resulting in loss of limbs and vital organs. Hundreds, if not thousands, of others suffered severe psychological trauma from which recovery is, according to current medical thinking, not likely. So we're not talking about esoteric political failings. We're not talking about really inconsequential trespasses to property. We are talking about the gravest and most serious crimes that can be imagined. Now, in fact, it's curious that Gonzalez called the Geneva Conventions obsolete. He had some company in that view. You see, early in the Second World War, a group of military lawyers wrote to their Minister of Defense pleading for a rigorous application of the Geneva Conventions and the law of war. And the minister, getting this memorandum, wrote a note on the side of it. This is obsolete, the thinking of a bygone era, not relevant to our current struggle against terrorism. That man was Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel. He was tried for crimes against humanity in 1948, and the U.S. prosecutor, acting under the direction of Justice Robert Jackson, quoted this language back to him and to the tribunal as an aggravating circumstance justifying imposition of the death penalty. Keitel was hanged. I don't believe in the death penalty, by the way, which may be good news, too. Now, we know that Gonzalez, when he was acting as senior legal advisor to the president, also received an appeal from the nation's military lawyers, from the Judge Advocate General's Corps, from the Judge Advocates General of the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps. All of them appealed to him to reverse this decision. These memoranda have now been published in the Senate after the Department of Defense shamefully withheld them for 2 years. And how did Al Gonzalez react to that? We know. Well, there's more. And the State Department, the legal advisor in the State Department, whose name is William Howard Taft, a good Republican name, and Will Taft is a good Republican, and we should remember that some of them exist. He wrote to Al Gonzalez these words, "These actions that you contemplated will be viewed by nations around the world as criminal conduct." So, Gonzalez was warned by the military, he was warned by the State Department, and he himself knew it was criminal. Michael Chertoff was the head of the criminal division at the time these charges were first brought. Now, today we know He's the head of the Department of Homeland Security. Everyone's been following Michael Chertoff's antics in connection with Hurricane Katrina, so I don't think I need to go into that. But let me focus on what Michael Chertoff did in connection with the Iraq War. At the beginning of this war, after Gonzalez wrote his broad memorandum about the Geneva Conventions and the reason why there was no need to really apply them, they then took to crafting specific memoranda, articulating specific kinds of torture and abuse of prisoners, and saying that this is okay. This was done so as to induce military and CIA personnel to use these techniques, to tell them you won't be prosecuted for this, even though on the face of it, it appears to be a criminal act. Michael Chertoff was involved in preparing those memoranda. And one of those memoranda included a technique known as waterboarding. Waterboarding is clearly torture as defined under the American criminal statutes. These memoranda have not yet been published. They're being withheld for national security reasons. Alice Fisher is now the head of the criminal division. She was appointed 2 weeks ago. She was appointed when Congress was in recess. But the funny thing is, it wasn't in recess. Actually, it had been reconvened that morning to pass relief measures in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Alice Fisher was also involved in preparation of the torture memoranda. Tim Flanagan, now the Deputy Attorney General. Tim Flanagan was also involved in preparation of these torture memoranda. So we need to ask ourselves, why are the senior-most positions at the Department of Justice now filled with figures immediately linked to war crimes in the Iraq War? Why? And why does this Department of Justice now come to persecute American citizens who exercise the right of free expression in opposing that war? This doesn't reflect the administration of justice. It reflects just the opposite. It doesn't reflect the principles on which this nation was founded. It reflects the abnegation of those principles. Well, I'm a bit of a science fiction fan, and I don't know, how many of you have read Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451? In Fahrenheit 451, the fire department doesn't exist to put out fires. It exists to start fires. Sometimes I think Al Gonzalez has read Ray Bradbury too, and maybe is taking a cue, because increasingly in George Bush's America, the Justice Department doesn't seem to exist to prosecute crimes. It seems to exist to commit them. Now, some of you may think this interpretation I have, that these acts of writing the torture memoranda, for instance, our criminal acts, you may think that this is a somewhat extreme view. I have a document right here prepared by career prosecutors in the Department of Justice. It was classified and withheld until recently. It has not yet been published. And in this document, a senior career criminal prosecutor looks at the torture memoranda that were prepared by Chertoff, Fisher, and Gonzalez. And he reviews them against the law. And here is the conclusion at the end of the memorandum. Any person who takes action in furtherance of implementing this plan could inculpate all persons who were involved in creating this plan. This technique contemplated cannot be utilized without violating U.S. criminal law. That is the conclusion. And is that really so surprising? If you've read Mr. Gonzalez's memorandum, you know that a large part of that memorandum focuses on these questions. What will we do if prosecutors bring indictments against us for the scheme we are concocting? How will we immunize ourselves? How will we obstruct future prosecutions? This language led Anthony Lewis in the New York Review of Books to remark, "This doesn't look like the writings of a senior justice officer of the United States. It looks like the musings of a mafia lawyer." And indeed, that's what it is. So, Scripture says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish. But he that keepeth the law, happy is he." And the devastation that has befallen our land, we see the truth of the words of the Lord's word. Vision is the responsibility of leaders and of government, but it's also a responsibility of every one of us, of all the citizens. When the government goes blind to morality and the law, the people must uphold it or be condemned like their fallen leaders. George Washington said nearly the same words. Different words, but the same sense. Considering the injustice that was wrought by the British, just in the wake of the in the years leading to the Revolution, he wrote this: "When vice prevails and impious men bear sway, the post of honor is a private station." He's quoting in the first half of the statement words of Cicero, that very noble Roman who took arms against a usurper to salvage the institutions of the Roman Republic and who died in its defense. We live today in such times as George Washington imagined, for vice prevails and dishonest men bear sway. The post of honor truly is for private men, for the ordinary citizen, and for the four citizens infamously accused in this case. Their conduct shows the resolve of Cato and the bravery of Washington. They are the true patriots in this ordeal, and I am proud to stand next to them. Thank you.
Columbia Law Professor Scott Horton.
Following Scott will be John Bonifaz, constitutional lawyer, who is also a co-founder of After Downing Street Org, a national coalition of veterans groups, peace groups, and public interest organizations seeking a formal congressional investigation into whether President Bush has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq War. In February and March 2003, Bonifaz served as plaintiff's lead counsel in John Doe 1 versus President Bush, a constitutional challenge to President Bush's authority to wage war against Iraq absent a congressional declaration of war or equivalent action. Bonifaz represented a coalition of U.S. soldiers, parents of U.S. soldiers, and members of Congress, arguing that the president's planned first strike invasion of Iraq violated the War Powers Clause of the U.S. Constitution. I had the honor to hear John speak January 6th, down in Washington, and it's a pleasure to have him join us here in Binghamton with the St. Patrick's Four. John Bonifaz.
Thank you all for being here. This is a historic moment, and I'm proud to be part of this and proud to be on this distinguished panel. I'd like to talk about the first lie told about this war. The first lie. Not the alleged weapons of mass destruction, none of which have been found. Not the alleged link that Iraq, Saddam Hussein had to September 11th, none of which has been proven true. The first lie told about this war is that Congress voted for this war. Congress never voted for this war. Congress passed an unlawful blank check to the President of the United States to decide whether or not to invade Iraq. And Congress has no more the authority to delegate the President to the President, the power to decide whether or not to take this nation to war, than it does to exercise any of its other exclusive duties under the United States Constitution. And to understand the context in which this war began, we ought to imagine for a moment that Congress were to pass a resolution which states the following. The President is authorized to levy an income tax on the people of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to pay for subsidies to U.S. oil companies. Now, no amount of legal wrangling would make such a resolution constitutional. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution makes clear that Congress and only Congress has the power to levy taxes on the American people. And it cannot transfer, it cannot delegate that power to the President of the United States. Now let us turn to reality. In October 2002, the United States Congress passed a resolution which stated the following. The President is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to, one, defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, and two, enforce all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq, as he determines to be necessary and appropriate. Mr. President, you decide. You decide, based on whatever evidence or whatever lies you have, whether or not to take this nation into war. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, the War Powers Clause, makes clear that Congress and only Congress has that power. And we have to really go back to that day, 1787, August 17th, when the delegates to the Constitutional Convention turned their attention to this question: how would this nation, this young nation, be brought into war? Pierce Butler, a delegate from South Carolina, sought to grant this power to the President, arguing that he will, quote, have all the requisite qualities and will not make war but when the nation will support it. Elbridge Gerry, a delegate from Massachusetts, rose to object. He said he, quote, never expected to hear in a republic a motion to empower the executive alone to declare war. Gerry's objection carried the day. The framers knew all too well the dangers of empowering in one single individual the awesome responsibility of taking the nation into war. Kings and queens of Europe, who would send their subjects off into battle, often on their own personal whim. The framers sought to create a different model, one in which we the people, through our elected representatives in the United States Congress, would make this awesome decision. No one individual would have that kind of power in this constitutional democracy. The War Powers Clause emerged from that collective memory. Congress shall have the power to declare war. No other language in the Constitution is as simple and as clear. Thomas Jefferson talked about his desire to create an effectual check to the dog of war. George Mason said that he was, quote, for clogging rather than facilitating war. James Wilson, speaking at Pennsylvania's ratifying convention, stated, "This system will not hurry us into war. It is calculated to guard against it. It will not be in the power of a single man or a single body of men to involve us in such distress, for the important power of declaring war is vested in the legislature at large." Now let us turn 200 plus years later to that hurried debate that occurred on the floor of the United States Senate and the floor of the United States House in October 2002, weeks before a national election, when all members of the U.S. House of Representatives were up for re-election, and one-third of the U.S. Senate. This hurried debate, the White House sends a resolution to the Congress. And there were calls. There were calls by members of Congress for there to be more time to deliberate, more time to debate, more time to analyze the consequences of what the president was proposing, and to read the literal language of the resolution. And Senator Robert Byrd was the most eloquent on the U.S. Senate side in his opposition to this resolution. And he linked the debate on the floor of the U.S. Senate during that time to a revolution more than two centuries ago. "Mr. President," he said, "here in this pernicious resolution on which the Senate will vote soon, we find the dagger that is being held at the throat of the Senate of the United States. I say to my friends, we ought to pause and wonder if Captain John Parker and his Minutemen fought on the Green of Lexington for this piece of rag, this so-called resolution. When Parker lost 8 or 10 of his men, is that what they died for? This resolution? Is that what they died for? How about John Paul Jones when he was fighting the Serapis? He was the captain of the Bonhomme Richard when he said, 'I have not yet begun to fight.' What was he fighting for? Was he fighting for this piece of cowardice here in this resolution that gives to the president lock, stock, and barrel the authority to use the military forces of this country however he will, whenever he will, and wherever he will, and for as long as he will? We are handing this over to the President of the United States," Senator Byrd continued. "When we can do that, we put a sign on the top of this Capitol, and we can say, 'Gone home, gone fishing, out of business.'" Sadly, the majority in the United States Senate and the majority in the United States House did not heed Senator Byrd's warning and the others who stood in opposition to this resolution. And as we know today, it passed. And so in February of 2003, there remained one branch of government that could still stand in the way to this president's illegal march into war, and that was the federal judiciary. And we filed this case on behalf of a coalition of United States soldiers, parents of soldiers, and members of Congress, led by Congressman John Conyers, Jr. and Dennis Kucinich, suing the President and Secretary Rumsfeld for lacking the constitutional authority to wage war on Iraq absent a congressional declaration of war or equivalent action. We filed this on the morning of February 13th, 2003, and we held a press conference that same morning in the Old South Meeting House in Boston, which was a fitting venue, because on December 16th, 1773, more than 5,000 colonists crowded into the Old South Meeting House to debate a controversial tea tax. The meeting sparked the Boston Tea Party, in which the colonists dumped 342 chests of tea into the Boston Harbor. 230 years later, Charlie Richardson, the father of a United States Marine based in the Persian Gulf, stood before a bank of microphones and television cameras. Richardson was there to explain why he was among the plaintiffs filing suit that day against the president. "As the father of a United States Marine," Richardson said, "there is only one thing worse than the prospect of receiving a call telling me that my son Joe has been killed in battle. It is the prospect of being told that he has been killed fighting an illegal and unconstitutional war." Nancy Lesson, Richardson's wife and the stepmother of Joe, was there as well. She held a photo of Joe for the cameras. "We noticed," she said, "that those who say we got to go to war aren't going anywhere, nor their loved ones. It is other people's children," she said, "who are now in harm's way. Our children." She said a momentous decision to send the nation into war could not be made by one person. Such a decision had to be made by the United States Congress. The federal judiciary did not do its duty. It did not protect and uphold the Constitution. It stayed on the sidelines and refused to intervene and refused to stop this illegal march to war. But we now know. We now see the dangers of what happens when we invest in this one individual, President of the United States, the power to take the nation into war.